Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, Jonathan Gold takes us out for a modern molecular meal. The astonishing amount of food we waste every day.
If you think about household trash plus what gets picked up from the restaurants you see in your city or town, we throw out about 30 million pounds of food a year.
And I'll introduce you to the ambassador of alcohol, a man who gets drunk for a living. But first, let's check in with market manager Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season.
Who doesn't like strawberries? They're probably the most asked for item on the menu. And we're talking to David Karp, who is the premier fruit researcher and writer that we love to speak with whenever he's in town. Today, David, you are going to talk to us about strawberries, and you're going to take us to places we never knew existed in the strawberry world.
It's the best of times, the worst of times. The glass is half full, half empty when it comes to strawberries. We have an advantage over anything you can find in a supermarket, of course, because the strawberries that we can get here are fully ripe. You look for 100% ripe, and a lot of vendors, McGrath, Fairview, Harry's Berries, sell 100% ripe berries. So what do I look for in a berry? Well, aroma, of course, or what do I smell for? I walk by, and if there's a good aroma, that's a very good indication. I look for variety, and I wish that all growers would actually indicate what variety it is that they're selling. That's so important. A lot of the university varieties, I'm sorry to say, are bred primarily for endurance, for shelf life, for appearance, for resistance to disease, and some are better than others.
Now, what about Jerry Rutas and his wonderful Galante berries, which are very tender and probably wouldn't ship anywhere, but he brings them here and they're delicious?
Well, that is the paradigm. That's the prime example, textbook case of a non-university variety that's more delicious than anything you can get in a university variety that could and should be grown in California. Now, it was bred by, I'm not making this up, David Small of California Giant, based in Santa Maria. There's a big strawberry company, but they've actually closed down, sadly enough, his breeding program. It was tried by commercial growers, but it's too tender to be shipped. But here's the whole point. Where are we? We're at a farmer's market. They don't need 10-day shelf life. All we need is a 2 or 3 day shelf life, if that.
So, David, what you're suggesting now is with these amazing varieties that are not the university ones you talk about, but there is a plethora of fantastic strawberry varieties. So either we need to ask our farmers to grow these for us or grow them ourselves in our backyard.
Let me propose a manifesto for beyond the university strawberry. I suggest that extension agents, and I can think of at least three of them along the California coast in strawberry growing areas, do a test of both older and newer varieties of premium strawberries for local sale, number one. Number two, that based upon the results of those studies, that nurseries propagate modest quantities of those and make them available to local growers. Number three, that growers, both for farm stand and for certified farmers markets, test those varieties themselves, and the ones that succeed, they should plant and make them available to customers. We will then have stuff that will just knock your socks off.
Right. And farmers, I hope you're listening to this. Hopefully, we'll come back in a few months or a few next year at this time, and we'll have new varieties of strawberries. How exciting would that be?
That would be fantastic.
Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We're visiting now with Josie from Josie Restaurant, which is a wonderful Santa Monica restaurant. And Josie is here every week and is helping us, hopefully, with another wonderfully inspired recipe from the market that we could actually make at home.
Well, I was thinking, you know, on Wednesdays we do our farmer's market menu dinner at the restaurant, which is kind of a cult thing. I guess it's out now. And what I was going to do, I work a lot with Garcia Citrus, and I've done a couple salads. One we just put on the menu because it went so well as a special was the Bloomsdale spinach that they have right now. Gloria has it, Tutti Frutti has it, and it's a real crinkly, crispy spinach that's really great for salads, and it's also really great to saute. Mm-hmm. We're doing the salad with a little roasted spring onions and then oranges. Last month we were doing it with the Oro Blanco grapefruit and blood oranges, which I love to do those comparison because people see the blood orange and think it's going to be this sweet cherry type of orange, and it's a little bit tart. And then they see the Oro Blanco, which is white like a lemon, citrus. And when you look at it, you start salivating because it looks like it's going to be sour, and it's one of the sweetest. It's as sweet as an orange. Tonight, what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to get some of the colossal asparagus from Zuckerman, which everybody talks about Zuckerman, and I'm going to pair that with this navel orange that they have right now. It's the sweetest orange. I couldn't believe it. We take the asparagus, raw asparagus, and rather than peeling them from the head down, you know, to get the base of the asparagus, you know, you usually right. peel that off and use it all. We turn it around and you grab it from the base and you peel it forward with a carrot peeler and you just peel the whole thing. So you get these beautiful ribbons of asparagus. And then we're going to take some fennel. I think I'm going to get it Tutti Frutti's and slice that really paper thin and toss that with some nice olive oil. And I'm going to put sections and slices of the orange in there so you get a little pop of color. With just, you know, olive oil and lemon, and then probably throw a little scattering of some fava beans around. But it's real simple, and you can make a little citrus dressing with some squeezed orange juice, add maybe a little tablespoon of red wine vinegar to give a little tartness, and just that olive oil, salt, and pepper, and it's just simple and delicious. It's, you know, raw asparagus, you wouldn't think to do that, but it's a delicious combination with that.
Yeah, and the sections of the orange, you peel it, you have to take all the white pith off, and then pull the sections
apart.
Yeah,
you can use a knife or just by hand. Uh-huh. I'll pick a few smaller ones. The navels are really big oranges. But you can slice them into, you know, wheels. Mm-hmm. And you can also just take the sections out where you take it in between the membranes, which is really easy to do with a little paring knife. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a couple different shapes and a little exciting look into it.
That was truly inspiring. That was Josie from Josie Restaurant. And she's here and she's lots of fun. And she's always just on a creative tear. So great to catch up with her whenever we can. Join us for the next library panel. They take place at the Santa Monica Main Library. This time it's going to be on May 6th from 7 to 9 p.m. The topic is Menu Minuet, how chefs and farmers keep seasonal produce on the plate while maintaining consistency on the menu. We're going to be having Chef Akasha Richmond of Akasha. We'll have Mark Peel from Campanile. And the farmers are going to be Romeo Coleman of Coleman Farm and Alex Weiser of Weiser Family Farm. Our moderator will be Jonathan Gold, who, of course, is the Jonathan Gold of KCRW and the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the LA Weekly. It's at the Santa Monica Main Library from 7 to 9 p.m., free and open to the public. And as always, the chefs are going to provide market treats for the audience after the panel. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Last week, I spoke to Elizabeth Reut about a water recycling plant down in Orange County. I loved some of your comments on our Facebook page. For example, Charles Thompson wrote that recycled water will eventually become a necessity, so why not just start using it now? Alicia Atella brought up the still suit from Dune, which I admit that I had to Google before I understood what she meant. Another listener who lives in the OC agreed that recycled water tastes a little flat, but she also thinks that water recycling is a great response to California's drought. Join the conversation. Chime in on my Facebook page or leave a comment at kcrw.com/goodfood. It's Saturday morning, and that means Good Food and, of course, Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer from the LA Weekly. He joins us nearly every week. We're going to a little bit of a different place today, aren't we?
It's not a taco stand in Montebello, I'll tell you that.
No, this is the place you go to after you've saved all the money going to all those taco stands.
Right. We're going to the dining room in the Langham Hotel in Pasadena. The chef there is Michael Vottaggio, who is very well known from Top Chef and was also known as the chef de cuisine of the SLS restaurant Bazaar, famous for its molecular gastronomy. And the dining room, though it's as sedate-looking as any place in the entire world, I mean, it still has ships set into the walls. It has, you know, the kind of flocked wallpaper that would not have been out of place in the 1930s.
A venerable hotel dining room.
A venerable hotel dining room. And then you have Michael Vottaggio, whose idea of fine dining is different from other people's ideas of fine dining.
So give us an idea. When you go into this place, are you ordering a la carte or are you getting a tasting menu?
They only have tasting menus. So you can either get a $79 menu where you can pick four courses or you get a $110 chef's menu. And that's pretty much the choices you have. Though within the $79 menu, you can pick the courses that you'd like.
Okay. Tell me the dishes that intrigued you the most.
One of the interesting things was a langoustine that he cooked, you know, langoustine being the big crustacean, that was cooked simply and it was served on white asparagus that had been wrapped in a reduction of calamari and squid ink that had been made into a sort of emulsion or a gel and wrapped around the asparagus. So it was it was white asparagus, but it was jet black.
Oh, that's amazing. Was it actually wrapped or was it dipped in and then it dried?
I believe it was wrapped, though it could have been dipped. I think it probably involved liquid nitrogen. He has a tank of liquid nitrogen the size of a Buick in the kitchen, and apparently he goes through an entire tank in a week.
The whole thing about molecular gastronomy that I find really, really fascinating is, I mean, the brain is this amazing organ, and molecular gastronomy plays with the brain and how the brain perceives taste through changing up textures and temperatures and flavor.
I think if you were going to be confronted with a langoustine on some asparagus, you'd eat it in a second. It would be gone. That'd be fine. It'd be like a little fried quail egg, you know, cute. But with the black asparagus, suddenly things are different because you're not used to eating black food and there's sort of like alarm things that are going off in your head. And I've got to say the song from the old Alice in Wonderland, Painting the Roses Red, came to mind.
But once you cut into it, then you see that it's a black ring and then the white is inside, correct?
Right.
And did you actually get the flavor of the squid ink?
I wouldn't say it was a concentrated essence, but there was definitely sort of a marine tang to it that went well with langoustine. It was a really smart dish, I thought. He does another thing similar with a foie gras terrine. He makes a reduction of strawberry juice with yuzu and wraps it around this terrine. So it looks like a petit four or a wrap package or somebody that's done something very clever with fondant or...
Like you're going to get a pastry.
Like you're going to get a pastry, yeah. I mean, you know those like really elaborate Sicilian cakes that have the marzipan wrapped around them so you never know quite what you're going to get? It was very much like that. And you cut into it and there's foie gras. And it was accompanied with a madeleine that was so green and so flavored with arugula that the pepperiness just overwhelmed almost the baked good aspect of it.
That's incredible.
And there were little, like, roe size, like, things the size of salmon roe strewn around the plate that were made of Canadian ice wine vinegar. And those would pop in your mouth and give you, like, this sweetness and give you this tartness. It was definitely the most unusual foie gras presentation I've ever seen. And that's after a lot of foie gras presentations.
And, I mean, the thing about that is that when you break it down, the tastes are the familiar tastes that you would expect at a high-end place with foie gras. You get a little bit of sweetness. You get a little bit of, like, a sweet-sour thing, like with the strawberry, like some sort of jam. But it's just presented in a completely different way.
Exactly. And I like this restaurant better than I like Bazaar because it's personalized. You can tell that somebody back there has taken a long time and has been thinking very hard about it, as opposed to Bazaar, where you get the idea that people bring like vast trays of spherification through the dining room and like deal them out as if they're bonbons. I mean, there's something more personal to this. One of the dishes I think that you would be interested in is octopus. It was like three tentacles of octopus. It had the taste of buttered popcorn, but it was like butter flavored with popcorn as opposed to popcorn flavored with butter.
So it wasn't actual popcorn?
No, it was a popcorn bermani or something. It's strange. You got the flavor of the octopus and you got the flavor of the popcorn. And there was something that looked like those old-fashioned rolls of caps that we used to play with as kids.
Yeah.
This strip of things that were bright red with like holes punched in the middle of it. Pop, 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 pop. There was piquillo peppers that had been, you know, mashed and cooked into a puree and dried into sort of, I guess, a piquillo pepper leather and then punched with a real hole puncher.
Wow, how interesting. I have to go to this place.
You do have to go to this place. It's almost like being in the middle of one of those, you know, Baroque paintings. Where one way you look at something, you see like, you know, apples and pears and melons. And another way you look at it, you see a dying man lying on the beach. And another dish that I think you would find amusing was what he calls pastrami pigeon.
Okay.
Which was essentially a deconstructed Reuben. It had squab breast that had been cured like pastrami with lots of pepper and sliced and served with cubes of sauerkraut juice jelly and cheese crisps. And there were – something was flavored with rye in there, too. I'm sort of losing it at this remove. But you did it up, and the sensation in your mouth was actually like biting into a juicy Reuben sandwich. Then you look at it on the plate, and it's this perfect little twee presentation. But in your mouth, it's this big flavored
comforting. Deli thing. How funny. How odd.
And the sommelier there, Josh Goldman, who you may know from Bastide – serves creek beer with it, this sweet German beer. He says it's the equivalent of serving Dr. Brown's black cherry soda with the Reuben sandwich.
Oh, I love that.
It was very funny.
All of Jonathan's suggestions are on the Good Food Restaurant Map. Find it on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Selling home baked goods used to be a great way for a school to raise money. But bake sales aren't what they used to be, and in some places, they're now even forbidden. Helena Eichland writes the Table Manners column for Chow.com, and she's with me to discuss the state of the bake sale.
It's in a very sorry state, and I'm quite worried that we might actually be witnessing the death of the bake sale. Because in October, the New York City Board of Education passed a ban on selling homemade goods in schools during school hours, except for one monthly event that's PTA sanctioned. But otherwise, you're not allowed to sell any zucchini bread, any banana bread. If you want to sell things to make money for schools, you have to sell stuff from a government-approved list, which is all packaged foods. You can sell fruit and vegetables, but otherwise you have to sell packaged foods, including reduced-fat Doritos. So the government's basically saying reduced-fat Doritos are better than a homemade zucchini muffin.
Now, are they doing this because there were so many birthday cupcakes coming to school that it was overwhelming?
Well, their argument against home baking is that there's no nutritional information, no breakdown of the ingredients, and no per-serving calorie count. Like kids should be counting calories, of course.
That's just so off the wall and sad. I don't even know what to say.
Right. I was really upset about it, but thankfully a lot of parents in New York also freaked out, and they had a bake-in where they outside City Hall. And I don't know what the result of that protest has been. That was only a couple of weeks ago, but hopefully that will lead to some a retraction of the ban.
What about here on the West Coast? Do you have any information about how bake sales are faring in San Francisco or Los Angeles?
I think they're still alive and well here, and there is some. They are changing. They're not because of things like nut allergies, gluten intolerance, and other special diets, which we're seeing more and more of. But there is a simple way to accommodate that. You don't have to have everything on the bake sale table be some like quinoa date cookie. You just have to have one, at least one nut-free option, and ideally, you'd probably have like a vegan option as well. It's great. I want kids to eat healthy stuff, but I think if it's a bake sale and your goal is to sell food and make money for the new playground equipment or whatever, so I think it's okay to sell unhealthy stuff at the bake sale, like a chocolate cupcake or a brownie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it should be that's the time to enjoy that kind of thing. It's a treat.
Yeah, and even if a cupcake may have more saturated fat than a bag of reduced fat Doritos, it still sends a much healthier message because it teaches kids that you can make stuff for yourself from fresh ingredients, and it's okay to indulge once in a while if it's like a homemade treat.
I think it also gives parents the opportunity to bake with their children, to get the kids involved in making the food for the bake sale.
Yeah, and I think it's really great when parents do take the time to make the stuff. And you know, I would never judge a single parent who has to rush to Safeway at the last minute because their kid told them that night that there's a bake sale the next day. But when parents do take the time to make the stuff, it gives them the chance to cook with their kids, which is very important. And just from a kind of mercenary point of view, it makes way more money than selling Doritos because people know they can buy Doritos at the store down the street, whereas you can't buy like a homemade snickerdoodle.
What about also choosing to make savory baked goods instead of things with sugar?
Yes, that's an excellent idea. And you can make little things like empanadas that are easy to hold in your hand.
Yeah, and I would imagine that especially if the school is multicultural, it allows people to express their home food to everybody else in the class.
Exactly. But the one thing you shouldn't do, and I don't know if you've ever experienced this, is buy stuff from Costco or Safeway and then pretend that you made it.
Oh, that's really bad because everybody recognizes that stuff.
Well, I didn't recognize it at a bake sale that I went to a couple of months ago. Like, I love bake sales. I just really love homemade goods, even if they're not very good. Just the fact that somebody made them with their kids is so charming to me. But I went to a bake sale a couple of months ago, and the parents had bought stuff in bulk from Costco and then rewrapped all these lemon squares and cookies individually with ribbon tied around them. And they looked very delightful. And I bought a lot of them only to find out they were from Costco.
You were tricked.
Nothing wrong with that, but be upfront about it.
That's true. Be upfront about it. Well, it's going to be interesting to see. I really hope that LAUSD doesn't go the way of the New York City Board of Education. That would be just dreadful.
Yeah, it would be really tragic if kids have to grow up without any memories of selling brownies with their parents at a bake sale table.
Well, thank you very much, Helena.
Thank you.
Do bake sales give you the willies? Or maybe allergies prevent you from indulging in other people's home-baked goodies? Tell me, do you think bake sales are a good idea or just a carryover from another era? Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up next, food waste. It's astonishing how much food we throw out every day. From individuals to restaurants and convenience stores, I've got the horrifying details next. Stick around, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When we go ahead and clean out our fridge and discover a moldy piece of cheese or some unrecognizable container of leftovers, we might feel a pang of guilt as we just toss it in the trash. But probably most of us are unaware of just how much food we really waste. And as a country, well, the quantity of food waste is astounding. Here to share some numbers and details is Laura Wright. Laura, you started researching this by, I guess you just kept track of what food you wasted in your own house, right?
Yes, that's true. That was one part of it.
So tell me how you went about doing it.
Well, I certainly started by doing a little bit of chatting and library research and trying to figure out what exactly we know. And then, as you say, the other part was tallying what I throw out on my own. And so I decided to take on this project just after Thanksgiving, which is a time when a lot of us waste and eat a lot of food. So, part of the process was just taking an inventory of everything they've got in the fridge and how much of it is still edible and how much is not, and how much is actually going out the door. So I sat down with a food scale and I weighed every last item of food that was going out the door that day. And I was blown away by how much I was throwing away.
The first few days, what were some of the numbers? Was it ounces or pounds?
I measured things in ounces, and then I converted it into calories because that made more sense to me as a woman who pays some attention to how much I eat every day. And it came out to about two full meals a day that I was throwing out.
Wow. How many people live in your house?
Two. So now this, keep in mind, was after Thanksgiving feast. So it was a little bit higher than I think what I normally would have thrown away, but still pretty surprising because I don't think of myself as a wasteful person at all.
So let's go ahead and let's talk numbers. How much food do we waste in our country that we can actually quantify?
We waste about 40% of all of the food that is grown in this country, which is really
huge. Wow. That's criminal.
Some would certainly say so. And when you start to break down those numbers, it gets worse.
Okay, go ahead and do that.
Well, one way to think about it is in terms of the resources that go into producing that food. About 80% of the fresh water that's consumed in this country goes to agriculture. And of that, 25% goes to food that never gets eaten. So that's huge.
Now, is this food that gets thrown away before we even see it or after we finished eating or both?
All of the above, but surprisingly, the worst offenders here don't tend to be the farmers on a relative basis. So it's not that we're saying we're not harvesting things because we've, you know, decided to just leave them in the field. There is some waste there, but most of it comes on the consumer end. And that means that the waste comes from your own household as well as food service establishments. So, you know, whether it's a cafeteria style place or a mom and pop restaurant, most of the waste comes in that domain. 95% of all food waste is on the consumer level. If you think about municipal waste, and that would be household trash plus what gets picked up from the restaurants you see in your city or town, we throw out about 30 million pounds of food a year in that way, which is enough to feed all of Canada over the same time period. So that's another way to think about the magnitude. But there are certainly some solutions out there that don't necessarily involve remaking our entire food supply, though that is part of it. Part of the problem is this, what's referred to as the wealth effect or the push effect, which means that the more that's out there, the more we'll eat. It's a consequence of the supersize me world we live in.
As a restaurateur, I'm really acutely aware of how the consumer views the amount of food on their plate. And when I watch plates come back into my kitchen after people are done with their meal and they're going to the dish area, I often think, boy, I'd really love to cut down on the portions I serve. Yet I know that if I did that, there are quite a few people who would be offended.
Yes. And that gets into the whole, the sociology and the culture of this problem. It's not so easy to just say, well, serve smaller portions. That's much easier to do at home, and that's one area where there are some ways to make changes. But culturally, it's a very difficult problem for us, and it ties in with a lot of other similar problems that, you know, tie in with the wealth effect, as I said, where more is available, so we think we want and need more, and then we waste more.
Do certain kinds of stores that we shop in or retail establishments where we consume food have more waste than others? Like, what about convenience stores?
Absolutely. Convenience stores are among the worst offenders. And any place, really, where you have a lot of food that has already been prepared and is sitting there waiting for some hungry mouth to come by. At convenience stores, if it happens to snow that day and you've made several dozen hot dogs and nobody comes in, well, you're just going to throw all those hot dogs away. So places where, again, there's pre-prepared food ready to go, that's where the waste tends to be highest. And on the other end of the spectrum, as you say, that you do have some waste in your restaurant, but it's probably nothing compared to some of these other places. Mom-and-pop style restaurants tend to have less waste. They're more cautious and careful about what comes in, what goes out.
So is there any hope?
I think so. I think there's a lot of hope. And I think it really does start at home with just some awareness of how much you're eating, how much you're throwing out. And it's not to say that we all have to, you know, start ordering fewer dinners out or completely changing your lifestyle, but it's the slow awareness of taking stock of what goes in and what goes out of your kitchen and a little bit thinking of grandma, sort of. It sounds a little corny, but My grandmother was certainly one of those people who said, you know, how could you leave that food on your plate? There are starving children in Africa. And it's not that we need to start reciting that to our kids, but we do need to start thinking a little more about what happens with the food that doesn't get eaten. Are there ways to use leftovers creatively? Or composting is another way to prevent things from going into the waste stream, even though it is technically a food loss. So some of that awareness is starting to come back into the picture a little bit, and I think that's hopeful. And on top of that, one of the things that I started to find out more about was the food recovery efforts that go on in this country. There's a website called feedingamerica.org that helps people find ways to give away canned goods, and larger establishments can give perishable foods to organizations that help feed the hungry. So there are ways to sort of shunt the food that would otherwise go into the landfill and make some progress that way, too.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you so much for writing such a thoughtful article and for making us think about this issue.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here with you.
Laura Wright wrote about food waste for On Earth, an environmental magazine where she's the senior editor. A link to her piece is at kcrw.com/goodfood. In some areas off the East Coast, the government has imposed a ban on fishing, which has really affected restaurants serving grouper and snapper. Mark Mahefka is a second-generation fisherman in South Carolina, and he's decided to get really creative. Could you tell our listeners what the ban on fishing is along the eastern coast?
In essence, what it is, we've got a couple of different species that are closed for spawning season closure, and then we've also got a huge area that they're proposing to go and shut down for all of the red snapper catch. And we interact with all different kinds of species in that area. And so it's a 10,000-square-mile area. It's pretty huge, and it's going to impact us greatly.
What fish are included?
Gosh, everything that we have in our snapper, grouper, reef fish complex are there, from groupers, all the different groupers, to the vermilion snappers, to triggerfish, red porgy. I mean, just on and on and on. There's a lot of fish. And if you ever go to an aquarium, I always tell folks, just look inside the big tank, and that's pretty much what a complex looks like, and that's what we fish on.
Now, all these fish, as you're saying all these names, it seems like these are fish that are really popular in southern restaurants.
That's true. That's true. These fish have really taken off, and when you want to come out to the East Coast here and eat fresh local seafood, that's what you're looking for.
So instead of being put out of business, you decided to come up with a solution, which is different than what you've done in the past. Tell us what you're doing.
Basically, what we're doing is I started Abundant Seafood about 3 years ago, and I've sort of sliced out some of the middlemen. I've done all aspects of the industry. I've trucked it. I ran a fish house, a retail market, and a cut house, and I just got back on the fishing boat about 10, 15 years ago, and now things have changed again, and I'm seeing that I'm having to go back to selling my own product, and so we're catching the fish offshore and talking to the chefs via satellite telephone and getting our orders all prepared before we even get back to the dock. And it seems to work out really well with them. They're able to go and sort of structure what they can go and purchase through the week. And it's really a great way to go and market yourself.
And what are these other species of fish that you're able to sell to the chefs, and are they familiar with them?
Most chefs are all familiar with the species that we have in our area because they've either been brought to them by other purveyors or other fishermen from time to time. It's just whether or not they want to go and come out of their comfort zone. And here on the East Coast, everybody wants to go and serve grouper. That's the big menu item here. And with our groupers being closed right now, what we're doing is we're introducing them to golden tile fish.
And what else besides golden tile, what other fish are you selling that you didn't used to sell?
Gosh, we've sold everything right on. It's just some have, you know, increased in value and increased in demand more so than anything. I mean, we've always were able to sell, you know, except maybe, you know, 40, 50 years ago, just might have been snapper boats, or we were just catching red snapper, and that was it. And then we became snapper grouper boats, and now we're fishing boats. We've evolved.
Now, you're also working directly with home cooks, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. This year we started off our first 12-week cycle in January and have started a CSF, which is stands for Community Supported Fishery. And what we've done is we're selling shares to the community just the same way you would do in a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. And it's a little bit unique because I am only one boat doing this, as to where my chefs get first pick of what's on the boat, and then whatever's left over is what the community gets. And it's really been great. It all sort of works hand in hand with the chefs, because the same people who are enjoying my fish right off the boat want to go to these fine restaurants and eat the fish also that I'm selling to the restaurants. So they ask for it, and everybody's wanting to go and duplicate the same thing that they had when they went to the restaurant, which is really fun when you get everybody together in a community and they all start talking about how they're cooking their fish and what they're doing with it and everything. It's really fun.
If things were to change, if stocks came back, would you ever go back to fishing the way you used to?
You know, we haven't really changed the way we fish, except for what we're not allowed to go and catch. And basically, when you get onto a pile of fish and you're fishing on a fish that you're not allowed to go and retain, you pull off of that area. You don't go and continue. We use vertical hook and line to go and catch these fish. They're not long line or nets. So when you fish for these fish, you'll make a couple drops, and if you're catching something that you're not allowed to retain, you move on. And so, we run away from a lot of fish that want to bite to go and find something that doesn't want to bite sometimes, so to speak.
Mark Mahefka's company is Abundant Seafood. Everyone in the food world has a way in. A lot of it has to do with food, but it's also usually something else. For me, it was a trip to Italy when I was a teenager. For Kim Severson of the New York Times, her way into a full and honest life were lessons learned from 8 cooks. Her new book is a memoir, Spoonfed. One of those cooks was legendary cookbook author Marion Cunningham.
Well, she was one of the first stories that I was assigned when I got a job at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I had been working up at the Anchorage Daily News before that, and Michael Bauer, who's the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, for reasons I still don't quite understand, decided to take a chance on me and hire me to write about food full-time and more food news. You know, I had kind of a hard news background and before I got into food, and so I think he thought that would be helpful. So anyway, here I get this job, and right about that time, it became very apparent to me and people around me that I had a serious drinking problem, and I knew that I had to stop. And so here, I think, is the great cosmic joke of my life. I get a job writing about food in the Northern California, just mere moments from some of the greatest wines in the world, and I can't drink a drop of it. So here I am, newly sober and completely freaked out and thinking I'm in over my head, and I go to San Francisco, and I have to go out and interview Marion Cunningham, who is a friend of my boss and this great legendary, so I go to her house in Walnut Creek, and I get there, and I'm terrified. And we start to do the interview, and I tell her, after we complete talking, I tell her a little bit of my story about how freaked out I was and that I didn't, I was new and I was getting used to California. And I remember her saying, well, you seem pretty terrific to me, dear. And that just was a great, huge relief. But then she said another thing to me. She said, well, I remember having to start over. And she talked about her own drinking problem and that she quit drinking when she was 50 or so. And of course, my ears perked up. I was like, I couldn't believe it. And then she went on, of course, to be James Beard's assistant and do all her great work with the Fanny Farmer cookbook and all the other things. But it was that moment when here was this person who had shared the same problem I did, who got over it, and who just reached out for that 1 minute and said, you seem pretty terrific. And, it made all the difference. And it was a subtle moment that I think things like that happen to us all the time. And luckily, I was there to show up and hear it and recognize it when it happened.
When I first picked up your book and I started to hear about it, and I realized that Rachel Ray was one of the people who spoon-fed you some life lessons, I was really intrigued, because Rachel gets a lot of beat down from, quote, serious culinary press. And I just couldn't wait to open up to that. I think I read that chapter first.
How in the world could she even include Rachel Ray in this book?
Well, I so respect you, and I so respect your intellect that I
until that moment, right?
No, not at all. That I was just really curious to see how it all unfolded. So why don't you unfold it for us?
Well, the Rachel Ray is such a kind of a crazy shooting star that it's fascinating to be around her, and I wanted to write about her. At the times I wanted to do a profile, it was a little bit hard to convince the editors of the New York Times, a dining section, that Rachel Ray was a person to write about at that time. It was before she had the TV show and the magazine, and her star was just really starting to rise. And I thought she was interesting. And I thought she was interesting because in some ways she picked up the mantle that Marion Cunningham had dropped and carried another generation back into the kitchen, if you really think about her as this bridge from the kids who maybe grew up with a Food Network in the background, but their parents weren't cooking. She really did help lead people back into the kitchen. So I thought she was a good story. Hung out with her a lot. I had a lot of late night phone calls. For some reason, we just kind of I clicked with her, and she would call me even after I got done reporting the story. She'd continue to kind of call and talk about things, and she goes a mile a minute. But I got to see where she started, and seriously, she was. I mean, the girl was just hauling her little demo cart to the Price Choppers in Schenectady and Albany, you know. I mean, she's works hard and was working hard from the start. So I admired that a lot. But anyway, then I started to get kind of, she got really big all of a sudden. And I'm feeling like, you know, I got this kind of big shot celebrity calling me, and what's that about? And doesn't that, you know, aren't I just the special queen of Sheba, right? But it really gave me a chance to examine, you know, my own attraction to, and I think all of us are attracted to celebrity in kind of a strange way, even if you act like you're not. If you want to, you know, if Jennifer Aniston was walking through the, you know, through the street and you saw her, you'd tell somebody about it because there's something about that. So, but I got to examine that. But I also got to examine who I really was in this food world and who I was in the world in general, and what I authentically, you know, my authentic place on this earth. And I think one thing about Rachel is she is very much her authentic self, and that's what she pursues and does. I mean, granted, I think there are a lot of people who say she's not to their taste, but I do think she is authentic. And it did make me think about who I really am, and I'm never going to be, you know, a fancy celebrity, and I'm a girl from Wisconsin, and I'm, you know, I'm always going to be just a little bit overweight. I'm terrible with money. I am, you know, I am who I am. I don't tan well. I never will. Just have to accept who I am. And that authenticity and working hard were two lessons that I really got from kind of the whirlwind of being somewhat close to Rachel Ray. So in a way, I think I admire her for, you know, and she takes a lot of crap. She really does. And, you know, I think she's done pretty well with it.
Kim, thank you so much for delivering such a really thoughtful and interesting book.
Well, thank you so much for reading it and having me on the show.
I asked you on Facebook who some of your culinary role models are. Answers varied from MFK Fisher to your grandmother. Thanks to everyone who shared. I'd have to say that I'm still collecting mentors, but some from the past are Elizabeth David, Patience Gray, Marcella Hazan, Etta Servi-Mocklin, and Joyce Goldstein, just to name a few. Coming up in 1 minute, wine from India. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
Thank you.
When digging into a plate of Indian curry or palak paneer, you probably want to pair it with Indian beer, maybe a nice cold Kingfisher. But I've got another option for you, wine. Meera Advani Honeycutt is here to educate us on the new Indian wine industry.
It's extremely brand new, and I would call it, it's in its embryonic stage. And quite honestly, my first taste of Indian wine, I was in Mumbai 10 years ago, and a friend of mine took me to a lovely new, trendy, looked like a very LA restaurant called Indigo. We went there for a little dinner, a supper, and he said, try some Indian wines. And I tried something called Sula, Sula Sauvignon Blanc, and 10 years ago, and was just fairly new at the time. And, you know, at that time, I said, you know, this is not bad. This is not bad wine. So I started exploring and looking and learning. And cut to now, I was in Mumbai a couple of months back, and there was a Mumbai wine festival going on.
Isn't that fabulous?
It was amazing. And so now I'm walking around something like 20 booths, wine booths, at the radio club. It's one of those old British Raj kind of clubs right by the ocean and by the sea. And I tasted close to 20 different Indian wines. And they're all coming out of a region called Nashik. And
where is that?
It's about 180 odd miles outside of Mumbai. And it's the newest growing region. That's one. And there's another one in the south called Nandi Hills.
Now, are these, it gets so hot in India. Do these have special microclimates, these areas? Are they at elevation?
Nashik is at an elevation starting from 600 feet to about 2,000. It does get warm, but they do their harvesting January to March. Because then it gets heat and the monsoons come. Monsoons come around and May, June, July, you know. And around that time, the highest temperature can get to be about 90 degrees and the coolest can be 50. There are a couple of indigenous Indian grapes, but nobody talks about them and nobody, I don't even know what they are.
Indigenous Indian grapes for eating? Because I haven't even ever really...
They're not even used as wine grapes, but they are there as wine grapes. And I wouldn't even go into pronouncing those names. You know, nobody's growing them. But the popular grapes are Cabernet Sauvignon, Shiraz, Sauvignon Blanc, which does very well, Merlot, some Zinfandel. They're also doing Chenin Blanc. And they're doing blends of Chenin Blanc with Semillon, with Chardonnay.
Now, are the winemakers young folks who have decided they want to just be explorers and try something new, and they're trained maybe in California or in France, and then they go back?
No. All winemakers are hired from, winemakers hired from Australia, France, and Italy. So in Nashik, there are grape growers, and they will grow the grapes and they'll give it to some of the big wineries. Now, there are three major big wineries that really, I would say, are the pioneers of the Indian wine industry. Chateau Indige, which was the first one established in 1982, then Sula, and then Grover Wines, which is in the south outside of Bangalore. And so those are the three big ones, and they make anywhere from 100,000 cases to 200,000 cases a year, and it's primarily for the Indian market.
That was going to be my next question. Who is drinking this wine?
Now, wine drinking is a trend now, and wine festivals are fashionable things to go to now. And there are wine bars in Mumbai, in Delhi, in Bangalore, lots of them in Bangalore. So it's like a very young thing to do. And it's also for women, the urban, sophisticated women. She wants to go out and have a glass of wine. And a lot of these IT kids, you know, who are making money in call centers.
Yeah, the burgeoning middle class.
Exactly.
Now, what is the Indian relationship with alcohol? Have there been traditional alcoholic beverages that have always been drunk? I mean, everybody knows about Indian beer.
Beer, right. See, traditionally with an Indian meal, we don't drink alcoholic beverage with a meal. Our drinking is always before a meal.
Do the wines yet compare with wines made in other great growing regions of the world?
You know, right now the industry is so new that I don't think it's really making a dent. But what they are doing, some of the big ones like Grover and Chateau Indige and also I think Sula, they're exporting wines to Indian restaurants, let's say in France, UK, and America. And here's a funny thing which I found when I went to the wine festival. Out of all those 20 booths, all the wine, the bottles look great. You'll see the packaging materials, the brochures, very fancy, beautiful. Inside the bottle. Hey, you know, it's a new industry.
Yeah,
Give them time.
It's a good to grow.
It's a good start. But they had names like all French names. I'll tell you, Revello, Chateau d'Ory, Val Duvin, and York Winery. All these fancy Western names. Because that appeals to the Indian market. Same wine when it goes to France or UK to an Indian restaurant, suddenly it has an Indian name, like Kama Sutra or or Karma or Moksha or, you know, these because there they're appealing to the Western market.
So interesting, isn't it? The psychology.
It's brilliant. I mean, the packaging materials, their websites, they look absolutely gorgeous.
Well, it's going to be something to watch. Thank you, Mira.
You're welcome.
Mira Advani Honeycutt has written a wine guide to California's Central Coast. Mira also contributes to the Good Food blog. Find some of her posts at kcrw.com/goodfood. Zane Lamprey gets drunk for a living. He hosts a show on the Travel Channel called Three Sheets, and he has a new book of the same name. He's currently on tour with his comedy show, Drinking Made Easy. He makes his living as a self-professed ambassador of alcohol. Are you drunk right now?
I'm not drunk. I did. You guys in your waiting room, you have that Jägermeister tap machine, so I did. I did visit it, you know, briefly.
Oh, yeah, we're famous for that.
But I'm not drunk. Yeah, the famous KCRW Jägermeister machine.
Actually, you can learn some pretty interesting cultural stuff through drinking in different places.
Sure. I get less out of traveling around when I go to a foreign country and getting on a bus and going and seeing the old statues and monuments from people that have passed away hundreds of years ago. I mean, that's great. And some of them are very beautiful, and it's wonderful to take those pictures. But if you really want to learn about a country as it is today, go into a pub or a bar, buy somebody a drink. You know, it costs you, what, $5 to $10?
I have to ask you, if you are doing this on a daily basis when you're on tour, how do you get up in the morning? Do you have a routine? Do you stick your head in a bowl of ice water?
That's a good one. That's a good one. Whenever possible, I'd love to just dive into a pool. That's like the best thing for me. But you know, I do have to think ahead, you know. I'll go out and sometimes do 4 or 5 episodes at a time. That means 4 or 5 different countries. And we don't take days off because that's a waste of money for production and a waste of time for us as well. I'd rather have my time off at home with my friends and family, you know. So I'll go out there and I've sometimes done 26 days in a row. And
brutal.
You just learn to deal with it. It's you know, it's fine. I can't, I'm not going to complain about being the guy who travels around the world and drinks for a living.
But,
I'm not going
to
do that.
I have to ask you this. Since every culture must have hangover food, aside from the whole drinking in a foreign country, does it give you an interesting insight to how people sort of get over drinking with their food?
The funny thing is that we still call things like hangover cures or something. There's no such thing as a hangover cure. There's not. It's sleep and fast food and some old movie you've seen 100 times that you can fall asleep to. You know, that's it. I've done 52 episodes. If I found a hangover cure, I would have brought it back here and mass-produced it and sold it and made a lot of money. It's like the hangover and the common cold, but no, I've
okay, so
found
let's
one.
Not talk about cure. I'm okay. Just really curious to know of like France, Germany, wherever in the morning did somebody say, here, eat this, or when you're getting
absolutely
out of
they
a bar?
They always do. I mean, it's always like everywhere I've gone, they do have a food that is the hangover remedy. Whether it's a, you know, a pig knuckle, it's a big pile of cheese, it's the Okie dog or whatever it is. Yes, absolutely. The tortas ahogadas, which is in Guadalajara, is a drowned sandwich. And they take a sandwich, fill it with like pork or chicken, whatever you want, and then they drown it in hot sauce. And it is just, you know, make your face turn red and make your eyes water spicy.
It takes your misery away from one misery and puts
exactly.
it on another.
Yeah, exactly. If your finger hurts and someone punches you in the nose, your finger doesn't hurt anymore. Yeah, or as bad.
What's the best city to get drunk in?
I would say a great one is Seoul, South Korea.
Why?
Because they love it. I mean, they're, you know, they started running out of space. There's something like over 20 million people in greater Seoul. And what they do is they'll take parking lots and they'll put up a tent bar. That's very popular. And there's some great ones here in L.A. There's like Mana, which I go to all the time, which is very authentic. It's exactly what it feels like. And people just go in there and they have soju and height and they just drink and they have an amazing time. And it's great.
And what's the worst city that you ever got drunk in?
I'd say the experience that was surprisingly the roughest was Barcelona. And we had someone try to steal the camera and we had someone try to pick a fight with us. And, you know, we have a rule that we broke on that. So I really can't blame Barcelona, you know, because it's going to hat you like that. I'm Castilian. It would happen anywhere. It happened. I did my show at Modesto this weekend.
I saw. I was following
your
tweets.
Yeah, we had. Okay, here's the casualty from Modesto. It might be Modesto as the answer to your question, because out of a crew of about 7 or 8 people, we had 3 speeding tickets. Nothing on these reminds. 3 speeding tickets, 1 impounded vehicle, 1 vehicle that was smashed the windows and broken into, and 1 vehicle stolen. That was in 2 days in Modesto. That's amazing. It's not like a punchline. It's nothing against Modesto. It's a fact. Those things happened in Modesto, and it was great. Thank
Welcome
you,
home.
Thank you. Exactly. Welcome home to the peaceful Los Angeles, right?
Thank you, Zane. This
Thank
has been
you.
Really fun.
Let's go hit that Jägermeister machine.
Oh, absolutely. Zane will be appearing at the House of Blues in Anaheim on April 30th. Share your hangover remedy with us at kcrw.com/goodfood or on my Facebook page. Did you know that we have an event calendar? Well, we do. We list lots of food events happening around town. For instance, you'd find out that Alice Waters is signing her latest book at Lost and Found in Hollywood from 2 to 5 p.m. If you want to take a look at that calendar, it's at kcrw.com/goodfood. Download our podcast and find info on all of today's guests at kcrw.com/goodfood. Sign up for our newsletter there, too. I share recipes and we do cookbook giveaways every week. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced and edited by Harriet Els, with Bob Carlson, Jillian Ferguson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Holly Tarson. This week's show is dedicated to Garlic the Tabby Cat. I'll be back next week for another edition of Good Food.